This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Sexual assault in the military is making national headlines.
So not only is it a crime, not only is it shameful and disgraceful, but it also is going to make and has made our military less effective than it can be.
Sexual assault reports among military members is a growing concern. The Department of Defense released a report on May 7th announcing a series of actions to prevent and respond to sexual assault in the armed forces. In fiscal year 2012, there were a total of 3,374 reported cases of sexual assault involving service members as victims or subjects, a 6% increase from the previous year.
The alarming factor is that the number of cases actually reported is just a fraction compared to what the sexual assault really is.
Last year, the Pentagon estimated that up to 26,000 men and women service members were assaulted in unreported incidents.
Sexual assault in our military is a crisis, and we need immediate action.
North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan attended a bipartisan meeting at the White House earlier this month with some of the president's top advisors to discuss the issue.
Three of the senators were former prosecutors who had actually handled a number of sexual assault cases in the civilian world. And over the last 20 years, great progress has been made in how sexual assault cases have actually been treated and handled in the civilian world. And I think the military justice system needs a huge wake-up call to look at what's happening in the civilian world and bring the best practices along those areas into the military.
Senator Hagan says one path to change is through new and pending legislation. On Wednesday, a House panel approved a bill that would take away the authority of commanding officers to change or dismiss court-martial convictions in rape and assault cases. This decision comes on the heels of a sexual abuse case that received national attention.
This happened just recently where a case actually had a guilty verdict through a jury verdict, and the commanding officer set it aside. That is just, you know, the fact that would never be able to happen in the civilian judicial system.
On May 5th, the head of the Air Force's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office in Fort Hood, Texas, was arrested for groping a woman in a parking lot in Arlington, Virginia. The Air Force has since removed Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Krasinski from the position and is investigating the incident. And on Tuesday, the Army announced the suspension of Brigade General Brian Roberts at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, over allegations of assault and battery. In response to recent allegations of criminal behavior by military recruiters and service members, a press release from the U.S. Department of Defense states that Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has ordered the services to retrain, recredential, and rescreen all sexual assault prevention and response personnel and military recruiters. Camp Lejeune, the largest military installation on the East Coast, has another distinction, as receiving the most reports of incidents of sexual assault in 2012. The number surpasses reports of sexual assault for other military installations worldwide.
By sheer numbers of people here, I'm not surprised that we have the largest number of reports of sexual assault. I don't think it's an indication that this is an extremely dangerous installation.
Marie Brody is the installation's sexual assault response coordinator for Camp Lejeune. She manages the sexual assault prevention and response program, which has been in operation for the last 8 years.
For fiscal year 2012, we had 125 cases reported aboard our installation.
So far this year, Brody says there are 73 open, unrestricted cases under investigation. Of those, 67 victims are female and 6 are male. About a third of reported sexual assault cases at Camp Lejeune occur in the barracks on base.
We have seen an increase in reports of sexual assaults, and it's very difficult to put your finger on why we have that increase and if it means that there are more sexual assaults occurring or if it means that we have more people coming forward and reporting.
The Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Program seeks to eliminate sexual assaults within the Corps and assist Marines and sailors affected by sexual assault. There are multiple portals of entry into the program. A victim may call the 24-hour helpline. They may also report to the Naval Hospital or go directly to law enforcement. In any case, a uniformed victim advocate will assist personnel with reporting an incident.
The Civilian Victim Advocate is going to talk with them about reporting options of both restricted and unrestricted. Restricted meaning you can still get help and support through medical, you can get counseling, you can use a victim advocate, you can go and talk to the chaplain, but law enforcement won't be involved and your chain of command won't be informed. The second option is unrestricted, which means, again, you can have counseling, victim advocacy, medical support, and your chain of command will be notified so that they can offer you support and law enforcement will be notified.
An investigation by the NCIS at Camp Lejeune will start immediately after a case is reported. The length of investigation and sentence vary widely, and there are no concrete numbers, according to Brody. But if a case were to go to a general court-martial and the person was found guilty, she says they could receive a 5-year prison sentence.
They would most likely get a dishonorable discharge from the United States Marine Corps. They might have to register as a sex offender. They would most likely get a reduction in rank. They would have forfeiture of pay.
In addition to providing assistance to victims of sexual assault, the program is designed to educate Marines and sailors on how to identify and report sexual abuse. Last year, the Take a Stand training course was offered.
Every non-commissioned officer in the entire United States Marine Corps had to receive this 3-hour course of instruction that teaches Marines and sailors about what sexual assault is, how it happens, the MO of an offender, how to detect behavior that is inappropriate and could potentially lead to a sexual assault. And the Marines and sailors are also taught about how can you intervene? How could you do or stop something if you saw some inappropriate behavior or some behavior that looked like it might lead to a sexual assault?
Brody believes the training is one reason for the increase in reported cases of sexual assault at Camp Lejeune.
Those courses were taught by our uniformed victim advocates, who are one of the people who has confidentiality and can take reports of sexual assault. So our Marines and sailors saw, this is somebody I can come to and talk to. This is somebody that I can trust and tell this report of sexual assault to.
As new legislation is introduced, lawmakers hope to put the brakes on the problem of sexual assault in the military. Now in committee, legislation sponsored by Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill would require a dismissal or a dishonorable discharge for a member of the military found guilty of rape or sexual assault. According to a press release, it would also prohibit a commander's ability to vacate or nullify a jury verdict, and would require a commander to provide written justification for any decision commuting or lessening a sentence following a guilty verdict in a court-martial. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East. On Wednesday, ScienceDaily.com reported on a 3D-printed medical device that restored breathing function for an infant, saving its life. The University of Michigan is credited with developing the tracheal splint that was emergency cleared for use by the FDA. The medical community is excited by 3D printer capabilities for building and reconstructing a number of tissue structures. Here in eastern North Carolina, East Carolina University in Greenville is experimenting with a new technology, as Stephen O'Connell explains.
A 3D printer's technical and less fantastic term is a rapid prototyping machine. Dr. Rick Williams was the horse or white knight who got the machines on campus. Williams has been working with the printers for the past 10 years, including time at Auburn University in Alabama. He has a box of gadgets and trinkets with him, including a wrench, a turbine blade, and brackets he uses for resistance tests in his classes.
So the tolerances aren't that great, so the wrench itself, although it's functional, you can see it doesn't necessarily move back and forth real smoothly.
The black wrench is made from ABC plastic, the same used to make Legos. The high-resistance plastic is shipped to them in string form, in spools, like a knitting ball.
But essentially what happens is this machine melts the plastic and it runs through an extrusion nozzle that extrudes it down to about 10 thousandths of an inch in diameter, and it prints almost like a glue gun, one layer at a time, in 10 thousandths of an inch increments. And so the build platform moves down every layer 10 thousandths of an inch, or there's 100 layers per inch. In the build.
For the name given, the printing process isn't rapid. The newest wrench has been printing for an hour when we get to the shop, and Dr. Williams says it will be a half hour more. Although fully assembled when printed, there's another disadvantage, most especially for the aesthetically minded engineer.
You see on this little model here, because you get layers, you end up getting this called stair-stepping that occurs. So anytime you have a curved surface, it's not going to be perfectly smooth.
Despite some obvious disadvantages, the opportunities the technology affords are striking, and the downsides are easily dismissed. The technical term that describes the type of engineering employed is additive manufacturing. Rather than its more widely used opposite, subtractive manufacturing, 3D printing uses materials that are recyclable and cheaper because it's built from scratch, so material is not wasted. But when it comes to the price of the printing machines, figures vary widely. A home version about the size of a toaster can be purchased for $2,000. The machines that Dr. Williams and Professor Agarwala use are in the $50,000 range. And as Dr. Williams told me, the prices don't slow there.
There are machines out there that are upwards of $1 million that the military uses to a lot of repair parts. They can do titanium, repair turbine blades, basically using lasers and titanium powders.
Dr. Williams is excited about its power to make ideas something you can hold.
Yeah, I think similar to Ranjit, it's seeing a student where they'll design something in CAD, and I think a lot of times when you're in the CAD environment, it's hard to see scale. You can zoom in, make it as big as you want, make it really small, and the picture's worth 1,000 words. But I think then if you have 3D models worth 1,000 pictures.
For audio of the entire report from Stephen on 3D printers at ECU, go to publicradioeast.org and click on the News tab. The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Crystal Coast Civic Center, Moorhead City, where every event is waterfront. Business meeting and special event facilities available. Crystal Coast Civic Center on the web at crystalcoastcivicctr.com. The Memorial Day weekend traditionally marks the start of the summer travel season. That means trips to the beach, and for the readers amongst those travelers, they want a good beach read, and an old-fashioned murder mystery always qualifies. One North Carolina author also provides scratches to two other itches in an ongoing series, something for mystery lovers and something for those partisan to the Old North State. George Olson spoke with the author of the Deborah Knott mystery series and has this, which originally aired in March 2010.
If you've read any of the 15 books in the Deborah Knott Mystery Series, you may have received a surprise along the way. Join the club.
Right now, the book that I'm working on, I'm 15 pages into the book, and I still don't know who's going to get killed. I don't know what the motive's going to be. I just start writing and wait to see what happens.
That's the author of the Deborah Knott series, North Carolina native and resident Margaret Marin. It seems odd, a murder mystery writer who sits down to write and doesn't know when the body will pop up or who it belongs to. But while Marin may not know the who or when, she is firm on the where.
And I wanted to explore the state and look at some of the issues that are facing the state. I've written about race relations. I've written about the furniture market. I've written about the problems pulling at our coastal waters. And I've just tried to take little snapshots of the state and show where we are and where we've been and where we're going. So I start with the setting, and then I let the story flow organically from that setting. Once I'm in the place, then I look around to see who could be a victim that would have enemies amongst the people in that particular setting.
Her latest book is Sand Sharks, set in Wrightsville Beach and Wilmington. This is actually a natural locale for her lead character, who is a North Carolina District Court judge in the fictional Colleton County and arrives at Wrightsville Beach for an annual summer conference of district court judges. The conference is a real event, and the judges have been kind enough to allow Marin to attend.
Over the years, several of them have said, oh, you ought to set a mystery here, you ought to set a mystery here. And a couple of them even had recommendations for who I could kill.
Setting also allows Marin to, as she terms it, get quite emotional about how I love this state. Nevertheless, each book isn't entirely something the local tourism board might quote in its brochures.
But I want to do the warts and all, not just the beautiful scenic part. I want to look at some of the problems. For instance, when I wrote High Country Fall, that took digs at developers who wanted to put housing developments right on the top of the ridges, and touched a little bit on the air pollution that we're getting over from Tennessee.
Likewise, 1994's Shooting at Loons was set on Harker's Island and wove the sometimes contentious relationship between sport and commercial fishermen into its storyline. Still, she uses her mystery series to, quote, write love letters to North Carolina, again, warts and all, while perhaps removing a few warts from literary depictions of Southern families with her portrayal of Deborah Knott's large and messy family.
Too often, people writing about the South, the families are so dysfunctional and they don't like each other. And I just wanted to show an ordinary family that happens to be a large family that like each other and enjoy each other's company. And I just wanted to show a functional family rather than a dysfunctional Southern family, which is too often the case.
In Sand Sharks, Deborah Knott has recently added to her large family with a new husband and his young son. The book opens with an argument, or was it an argument, with her husband Dwight over a small clash she had with their child Cal. That provides Marin the opportunity to work in a regular comic device she uses for her lead character, a three-way dialogue between Deborah Knott and her inner preacher and pragmatist.
Until I felt the tension draining out of my joints and muscles, I didn't realize how much stress I'd been under these last 5 months, adjusting both to marriage and to having Cal with us full time. This would be the longest I'd been away from both of them since January. But there on the hot sand, I finally admitted to myself just how much I'd been looking forward to this week. No personal demands, no stepmother tightropes to walk, only the give and take of professional life. And I wasn't going to feel guilty about enjoying it or let my anger with Dwight ruin it for me. Or so I told myself, because lying on my towel, I was beginning to feel thoroughly miserable. Just as you should, scolded the preacher from the shade of his beach umbrella. You know good and well that Dwight was clueless. If anyone needed to be jumped on, it was Cal. The pragmatist, who only wanted to soak up sun, gave an impatient scowl. He's a child, Dwight's son. She comes down hard on him. Who's Dwight going to side with? The preacher shrugged. So, any other child, one of her nieces or nephews, and she'd either laugh it off or tell him, good try, kid, but it's peanut butter and apples driving up. Y'all can stop for hamburgers on the way home. She wouldn't take it out on Dwight. He was right. What's the big deal? Cal doesn't respect her decisions. He's 9, for Pete's sake. If she's going to drop down to the 9-year-old level every time they butt heads, why should he respect them? Stomping off sure didn't help. I didn't stomp, I said. You stomped, they chorused. Very mature, the preacher sniffed. That only tells Cal that he won the round. Some role model you are. They are the two voices of her conscience, of course. You have the preacher who says, you know, we must always do good. And then you have the pragmatist who says, well, yeah, we should be good, but at the same time, let's not forget that if we can help ourselves, he's the one who will rationalize everything. And I started doing that because Deborah doesn't have a Watson. She's not Sherlock Holmes, and she doesn't have a Watson that she can bounce ideas off of. So she's going to be bouncing them off of her own conscience and her own sense of what's right or wrong.
Marin says with Deborah Knott, you have to suspend your disbelief that a district court judge would find herself so often at the center of murders, but beyond that, she wants her character as realistic as possible. Hence, the event that has her preacher and pragmatist in such an uproar isn't a dense web of lies and deceit stretching back into her character's dark past, but instead a debate over whether her husband and son should travel with a packed lunch rather than stop for fast food. In regards to the judicial system featured in Sand Sharks, Marin's preacher is thankful the judges allow her to attend conferences and answer her questions, but the pragmatist recognizes the system's dark side and uses that to fuel another episode in the reading public's seemingly insatiable appetite for mystery.
We would like to think that our judicial system is pure and that everybody comes to it with clean hands. But judges are politicians. They do have to run an election. They are not always appointed. And I know that there are judges who have things in their background. or the way they judge from the seat, from the bench, their actions are not always pure and noble. And in fact, they're downright dirty, some of them. So I took things that I had heard over the years about various judges and gave them all to this one character so that he would be despicable enough that he could make someone want to kill him.
Margaret Marin's latest book is Sand Sharks and is published by Grand Central Publishing. I'm George Olson.
A quick update on the author. Since this piece originally aired in March 2010, Margaret Marin has produced 3 more Deborah Knott mysteries, so we're up to a total of 19 for the series. Number 19 was last year's The Buzzard Table, also published by Grand Central.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. One of my memories from my childhood is the aroma of gardenia blossoms at my grandmother's house. I imagine many of you have the same memory from some home in your neighborhood or a family member. Gardenias grow beautifully here in the South, although they do have a few problems. Gardenias are appealing because of their creamy white flowers that have an amazing aroma. Any gardenia that you plant in your yard needs to be planted where you can smell those flowers when you're sitting on the porch in the evening or when your bedroom window is open. These flowers start opening in May most years and may go through July. However, about this time of year, I get panicked calls about gardenias every year. People call because they're afraid their gardenia is dying. The leaves are bright yellow and dropping off, and they don't know what happened. Well, take a deep breath. Although there are some problems that gardenias might have causing leaves to yellow, and we'll discuss those, this time of year, you're probably just seeing last year's older leaves dying and falling off the plant. Look closely. Is there new growth coming out that is a proper green color? If so, then your gardenia is just being deciduous, like it's supposed to be. Notice how the leaves of a gardenia are thick and waxy. It makes them particularly well-suited to the coast, where salt might be in the air. So, what else might cause gardenia leaves to turn yellow? Problems rather than natural occurrences. Well, overwatering certainly can cause yellowing of leaves, as will soil with an improper pH. A big cause of problems in gardenias is the white fly, which is not a fly at all. It looks like a small white moth, but it's not a moth either. It's more closely related to mealybugs, aphids, and scale insects, and it feeds on the plant sap with needle-like mouthparts. If your gardenia leaves are turning yellow, and this includes the new leaves, not just the old ones, and when you shake the bush, a cloud of tiny white insects flies away, you're looking at a white fly infestation. Another way to tell you have a white fly infestation is to look at the leaves and the stems in the lower and middle part of the plant. If they are covered with black sooty mold, that's another sign that white flies are there. The mold is not a problem for the plant, but it is living on the sugary excretions from the white flies. Look on the back bottom side of leaves and see if you see the adult white flies or the immatures. The immatures look a lot like scale insects, pale orange, round, flat discs stuck to the back of the leaf. Now, often natural predators will keep a white fly infestation to a tolerable level for the plant, and it won't really suffer. But if your gardenia is covered in white flies, drops lots of yellow leaves other than the leaves that are dropped in the spring, and is covered in black sooty mold, then some sort of intervention may be in order. Around the household, I would recommend that you try insecticidal soaps and horticulture oils first. Be sure to follow all of the directions on the label. You also can use synthetic insect products that contain pyrethroids to control whitefly, but these will kill the beneficial insects as well, and you may have a quick spring back of whitefly that's even harder to control. And if your gardenia just always looks weak and spindly and has never been as beautiful as you'd like for it to be, consider the fact that gardenias actually prefer light to moderate shade here in the hot south, with little or no competition from tree roots. They also want an acid soil. So maybe your gardenia needs to be dug up and moved to a better place. And remember, when selecting that spot, that you want that aroma to waft in through the windows in late spring and early summer. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.